They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
Yes, yes. We love you, Scal.
Well, welcome, everybody, to the first live Crossover Podcast. First time trying this. Very excited to be here at the Harp, talking a lot about the Celtics. Interesting season last year, to say the least, and we'll see what happens this year. But I want to introduce my panel, three guys that have joined me here for the evening. To my right, he's a columnist emeritus at the Boston Globe after nearly four decades at the paper. He's also a former National Sports Writer of the Year, enshrined as the Kurt Gowdy Award winner in the Basketball Hall of Fame. Please welcome Bob Ryan. To his right, I think he's one of the best beat writers in the entire NBA, now in his fifth season covering the Celtics for the Boston Globe, Adam Himmelsbach. And finally, he is the captain of the Big Three's Ball Hogs. When he's not getting muscled by Greg Oden on video, he is doing great work on the NBC Sports Boston broadcast. Former NBA forward, Brian Scalabrine.
Hey!
Wow, I got the same applause as you.
Is that okay, Scal? You all right?
Yeah, that was a tough week for me, trying to guard Greg Oden in the half court. Good luck.
Has everybody seen that? If you haven't seen the video, you were the center of your team? Was that?
I'm not really a position. We play positionless basketball. I just happen to guard Greg Oden. You know, 3-on-3 and going against 7-footers who can't move is not ideal for me, Chris. It's not ideal. But I would like to see you guard me in 3-on-3 and see how ideal it is for you.
No. And, you know, you said to me once, and it always resonated with me, that people try to kind of come at you.
No question.
Sometimes. And I think, and I'm paraphrasing you here, but you said something on the extent of, I may not have been super athletic for the NBA, but I'm way more athletic than you.
I say that to everybody out there, all the Joe Schmoes out there. I am way more athletic than you. It's just, I look slow because I'm going against, you know, Russell Westbrook, Derrick Rose, Rajon Rondo. Yeah, those guys will make everybody look slow.
All right, so last year was fun. Good times, okay. All around. Expectations not exactly met. With that team, they finished the year before a game away from advancing to the NBA Finals. They come in the following fall, a lot of expectations. They wind up losing in the second round of the playoffs. I mean, Scal, how shocking was the end of last year to you?
Not at all. The end of the season?
Yes.
Yeah, they made their bed. They had to sleep in it. It was not. I mean, what was shocking was the way they beat Milwaukee in game one. But after that and how the wheels fell off, we saw that at least twice a week. And we would see these runs that teams would go on, 33-6, 17-2. And there was no response. There was no fight in that team last year. And I think everyone kind of looked first to do it themselves. Then they looked to Kyrie. And then Kyrie looked to Jason Tatum. And everyone kind of looked around and someone it was going to be someone else's problem. So the end result to me, Milwaukee was such a better team than the Celtics at the end of the year. And, I mean, clearly those guys had a lot of people will say it's chemistry. I just think that the team didn't fit. It wasn't a great fit.
Adam, you were around that team every day last season. Was there a point during the early part of it where you kind of realized that, you know, this was going to be – there were going to be some problems with this group?
Yeah, I mean, you hate to, like, bring it all back to Kyrie, but very often it does. Because when you have a player of that caliber who guys look to, guys are kind of counting on to lead them. When that goes wrong, and then when the play starts going wrong along with that, like you had the Orlando game, right, where Kyrie didn't get that last shot. What did he do? He turns right to Gordon Hayward. What are you doing? Like, in front of everyone. And that was the first sense, like, when we're seeing that, okay, something's a little amiss here. After games, he starts criticizing over and over the young guys. We need the young guys to be better. Putting it on them. The young guys didn't like hearing that. They start then turning around. Well, like, who are you? You know, who are you to judge us? And all of a sudden it starts crumbling kind of piece by piece. And it just, like Scal said, it really just got worse as it went along. There were times where you thought, like, they'd have a couple of wins. And you'd be like, oh, they're putting this together. Like, it took a little while. And then all of a sudden it would just kind of crater after that.
Bob, you've seen every permutation of the Celtics teams dating back several decades. What did you make of the way this team kind of crumbled last year?
I was shocked at the extent of it. I didn't think that it was going to be a cakewalk year. When the season started, I said, this is going to be Brad Stevens' biggest challenge so far, no question, because we all had this great kumbaya feeling after the year before. The end of the year before was great. Didn't end fully with complete fulfillment. But I'm telling you something right now. I live in Hingham. Hingham is a hockey town. It's always been a hockey town. It's still a hockey town. And with the possible exception, and I mean only possible, of the championship team of 07-08, I've lived in that town 45 years, and there was more basketball chatter, people coming to me, you know, as an identifiable person who is associated with basketball, to talk up the Celtics. I'm talking about the year before in those playoffs, okay? More than any year since the Bird, since 85-86, frankly. That's an incredible statement. People love that team. They related to that team. Okay, now, we have that team coming back intact, and here comes Gordon Hayward, and here comes Kyrie. And I knew it was going to be a challenge for Brad to get this sorted out, to know that he was going to have to deal with egos, he was going to have to deal with guys who were having a reduced minutes and altered roles, and how would it all go? And well, it turned out he couldn't get a handle on it. He fell on his sword right after the last game, and he's right. I'm not saying anybody could have done it. I don't know who could have done it, but he couldn't, and he knows it. He couldn't get a handle on this with these people. So I knew it was going to be bad, but I never thought it was going to deteriorate the way it did. And I remember, you know, some of those games just horrifying. The blown leads were astonishing at point. I was down in Brooklyn too that night when they lost that big lead in the against the Nets, and not to mention the other games that you can all cite at home. So yeah, it was a totally disappointing season.
Scal, when you are making, or fans are making, kind of the blame pie for last season, Kyrie gets the lion's share of it. Do you think that's earned?
No. I mean, I think everybody had a part in it. If you look at the beginning of the season and you look at some of the shots that these guys were taking, the pull-up jump shots, the isolation, like Brad never wanted to play that way. And then you add Gordon Hayward into the mix, and he was taking a lot of pull-up jump shots because that's what he worked on when he was hurt, so he couldn't really explode and get to the basket. And I think everyone, when it went south, Kyrie stepped up and said the things that he said, which he probably shouldn't have said those things. But from a basketball standpoint, you were never going to win playing that style. Now, they need to change things up this year. I'll just bring two stats up for you, right? 29th in the restricted area, that little half circle in the paint. 29th in points in the restricted area, 30th in free throw attempts. So you can't win basketball games playing that style. You cannot win basketball games shooting just pull-up jump shots. And everybody got back from their personal trainers in the offseason, and all you saw was pull-up jumper after pull-up jumper after pull-up jumper. So I don't think that's Kyrie's fault. Like, Jason Tatum working out with Kobe is not Kyrie's fault. That's Jason Tatum deciding he wants to play the Kobe Bryant that was 15 years into the league. I remember Kobe in his second year, he was dunking on everybody. So why didn't he teach Jason Tatum, you know, that style of play?
Adam, the difference between Kyrie from two seasons ago to last season, I mean, when he went down at the end of that 17-18 season, everybody thought all was lost. They wound up turning it around. What was the difference in Kyrie that season and the one you saw this past one?
Well, that's the crazy thing. If you look even statistically, last year was probably the best season of Kyrie's career. Would surprise a lot of people even to hear that. The problem is the wins didn't necessarily come with it. And I think Scal brought up a good point. Those first 20 games, when they started 10-10, during that stretch, the biggest issue was Gordon Hayward wasn't himself, and he was still playing huge minutes. Yep. So that caused, you have one, a player who's not ready for that moment, who's kind of setting the team back. And then we had players start to resent him, who are not playing, saying, wait a minute, like, I can do better than what he's doing right now. What's going on here? And that's a little when things started to boil over. And then, kind of like Scal was saying, people looked to Kyrie. All right, things are going wrong. It's your job to save us. And he couldn't.
Yeah, Bob, I did hear that a lot at the end of the season where, you know, people close to players in the Celtics would say they felt that Gordon was babied. At the same time, it's kind of a catch-22. You almost have to baby him to a degree because you have to get his confidence back after an injury like that.
I don't know if he was, you know, what verb I would use, but he was certainly given an opportunity or more opportunity to play than he was, turned out to be warranted, and Brad wanted to get him back in to be the Gordon Hayward that he was, and he wasn't ready to do that. And as Adam said, I'm glad he brought that up because that was something that I thought about all year long. The guys, the young players, I'll name names, Tatum and Brown particularly, are thinking, hey, why is he getting this time? He's not warranting this time. It's not, you know, I can be doing this time. I'm not going to put Morris in there. You guys help me out because you're closer to the team than I. Morris turned out to be the second best player of the team in the first half of the year after Kyrie, right? He was never that kind of problem that I know of. But the younger player, and particularly, I'm most disappointed in the way Tatum reacted. And the way Tatum did not show any progression last year, and I'm not going to go so far as to say he regressed, although I'll leave that to these guys to tell me. But he certainly didn't progress the way we thought he would, because at the end of the year before, let's face it, there was all kinds of wonderful praise being lavished on Tatum, and I was part of it, believe me. And I thought, oh, this is what a great find. And he did not come through last year, and I think he was part of the problem of resenting the attention and minutes given to Hayward.
Scott, what did you think of the handling of Hayward last year?
I mean, I get it. For you to beat the Bucks or beat Toronto, you got to have Gordon Hayward how he was a year ago. So what's your choice here, right? If you go out there and you make him earn his minutes, let's just say like you want to do that, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum are looking at Gordon Hayward saying you're gifting minutes to him. He'll never get to where he needs to go. He'll never get to where he's at, hopefully, this season, right? But so you have to kind of go through that with him, because the only way you're ever going to get over the hump, there was a glaring weakness in that year before team that everyone loved. Everyone loved that team, and they were a couple of possessions away from winning it all. Or I'm sorry, for going to the finals. But no one can get to the paint and make a play for someone else. Gordon Hayward was brought in here to get to the paint and make plays for other people. So, yeah, they needed Gordon to be that guy. The problem is Gordon Hayward, guy who got downhill, guy who had a physical presence at the rim, was no longer there. So I think that's why it took Brad a little bit of time to sort of like pull the reins back on Gordon, saying, if you're not comfortable, which we all saw it, Gordon would go to the basket, I don't know, he would flinch or he would not explode or he would close his eyes, whatever the reason, when he went to the basket, it didn't work out. At that point, Brad said, we got to bring you off the bench. And if you're going to shoot those pull-up jump shots, that's going to be fine, but we're never, ever going to get to our level with you not going to the basket. That's the whole point and reason you're here.
Adam, to turn it back to Kyrie for a second, you went to Brooklyn for the Nets media day. You asked Kyrie about what happened, what caused him to change his mind. It was, like a 7-word question that turned into a 4-minute answer.
Over 4 minutes. I think it was the longest answer Kyrie's ever given.
Well, what did you make of his answer to that question?
So with Kyrie, you know, as journalists, we joke about it during the season. He gives kind of long answers, and a lot of it would just be kind of rambling, and you have to go in and find the sentence. Okay, I got what you're going for here. And then there'd be like a few more sentences rambling, and you have to kind of extract it. Look, he said, for those who have missed it, he said a big reason for his struggles last year was the death of his grandfather in October. There are certainly people who are skeptical of that as a reason.
What do you think?
Yeah, it's hard to say, because when it comes to something like that, you can never really get inside somebody's mind, you know? All I would say is that
there were people internally that were skeptical of that.
It would seem to me that if that was the case, something in October at some point, and he doesn't have to share everything with us publicly, but at some point it would have been, hey, I'm going through something right now. You know, here's what's going on. But that never once came out during the course of the season, either from him or from someone close to him. But he said that was kind of his early breaking point, I guess you might say, and things never quite got right after that.
Aren't you close with Kenny Atkinson a little bit, right?
I wouldn't know if I defined as close, but, you know.
When he heard that, he had to think, oh, my God, what did I get myself into, right? Like, when we all heard that, you're thinking to yourself, like, okay, so your grandfather dies 6 months ago, and you suck during the playoffs, and that's the reason why? Like, what happened? What's going to happen to us? Like, we're trying to win. You do have a job to do, right? Like, everyone here, I don't want to be that guy, but everyone has to kind of move on. And he was saying, I was not allowed to move on while I'm playing basketball. I don't know, man. Isaiah Thomas moved on pretty quickly, I guess. He was dropping 54 like a week later, so I don't know. I would just say if I was Kenny Atkinson or Sean Marks, I'd be a little worried right now, personally.
Bob, what did you think of Kyrie's?
I've said repeatedly that I have two words for anybody. First of all, he'll play for three more teams. This is
going to continue,
this
right?
This is not the end of it. He is who he is. He's going to play for three more teams, and at the end of each tenure, each of those teams will say, we couldn't figure that guy out. And I think that the two words I said this for Brooklyn, caveat emptor, buyer beware. Yeah, good luck with him. You know, he's an extraordinary talent. At his size, he gets to the rim as well as anyone I've ever seen. Get to the rim. He's amazing. No, I shouldn't say that. We had two of them in a row. Isaiah Thomas got to the rim pretty damn well, too. But he gets to the rim very, very well, and he's extraordinary talent. But the whole package, what my great mentor, dear departed Frank Power, used to call the connection between the brain and the body and the intuition and the whole feel and what are you out there for and the whole thing, the connection with him is still it's a little fuzzy. I don't think the connection is very clear.
Scott, could you sense when kind of the tide turned? I mean, if the apex
right
was
after All-Star break when him and Kevin Durant were plotting their next team they're going to. We all saw it on film. They all denied it.
You think that's what it was? You really think that's what it was?
Why would somebody do that in the hallway when they know they're getting filmed?
They covered their mouth. That's like the new thing to do now.
Under your jersey.
You, man, watch out for Brooklyn. They're good. For real? Yeah, Brooklyn.
If the Spencer Dinwiddie stuff's to be believed, it was like December when they started recruiting Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn.
Kyrie Irving called out his teammates in Orlando and then, these guys got to be better. These guys got to do this. These guys got to do that. And by the way, I'm sitting out the Brooklyn game. He sat out both games in Brooklyn. So
well, then DeAndre Jordan on Friday said they've been talking, the three of them, Kevin Durant, have been talking about it for several years. So who knows, like, what's to make of it?
I don't know. I mean, players colluding like that has become all too common in the NBA. It's not going to stop either. We're going to see them do that all the time. I want to ask you guys about Brad Stevens. Bob, you've seen a lot of Celtics coaches come and go. This was Brad's kind of first chance to coach a team that came in with legit expectations. What did you think?
What I thought was that he didn't pass the test. He knows it. And I also think that I have not abandoned him. I'm not bailing on him. I'm a big admirer of his. I think that at the end of the season, I said, okay, he will assess himself, and he'll look and say, well, here's what I did wrong. Here's what I didn't do. He will get, if he wants to seek advice, he'll seek it, and he'll get it from the appropriate people. I'm just too high on him in general to think that this was a setback. This was a moment in his career. It was a new challenge, and now he's absorbed it. He's lived through it. He's had to deal with it, and I think he'll be a better coach for it. That's my take.
Scal, did Brad struggle with Kyrie in ways you didn't expect?
I mean, wouldn't everybody struggle in that situation last year? I mean, he's asking these guys to compete. He's asking them to move the ball. He's asking them not to shoot the pull-up jump shot with 14 seconds on the shot clock. Yeah, he's asking all those things, and none of them registered. I'm with Bob. I think he's going to learn a lot from last year. It's been, I guess the first year was a little bit tough, a little bit of a rocky road, but it's been pretty unbelievable after that. Ever since the Isaiah Thomas trade, this whole thing has been going along, and they've been overachieving, playing hard, playing for one another. And I think it's like kind of a mark of his college teams. Last year was just the asterisk, and he's probably going to say, I'm going to learn a lot from that experience. We all learn from our failures way more than our successes.
I think part of that, too, when you talk about last year's team, I think Scal's right. Like the Jay Crowders, the Isaiah Thomas, they had assembled these teams with dudes who – had stuff to prove, dudes with chips on their shoulders. Last year's team had more talent than any of those teams, right? But some of them didn't necessarily have that, like, dog in them. The guys that Danny Ainge, I think, looks for when he's, like, evaluating draft prospects. But look, when you have exceeding talent, you're going to take that usually and hope that that competitive fire comes out, and it didn't. And I think the Celtics reassessed that this offseason. They said, all right, we need to get back a little bit to getting some of those guys that are going to play defense every single possession, that are going to be really pissed off when they lose and things like that.
Bob, I don't know if Kemba Walker is the guy Adam's describing. I think he tries on defense, but I don't think he's very good. But I think this town's going to like Kemba Walker a lot because of how hard he plays and just how overall positive that he is.
That was to you, Bob.
They're going to like Kemba, and he's going to thrive here. I'm not even remotely worried about him. I think he's going to be fine. The one thing I'm going to throw that bothered me, losing Al Horford was bad, and losing him to the Sixers, you know, the ancient rival, was worse and all that, although this generation doesn't quite have the feel for the rivalry. We haven't had it the way, you know, it was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and 80s, and 90s, you know, but losing both he and Baines bothers me. You know, the two of them. Aaron Baines was a useful player here, and I'm disappointed. I'm sad about that. So the combination. So they got a hole. They got a physical hole to fill there, and we'll see if they can do it.
I got a great story. It's draft day, right? We got 3 first round picks and Aaron Baines on our team. At the end of the night, we had 2 picks and no Aaron Baines. So Tommy Heinsohn, Scal, come here. I got a question. How is this a good draft? We got 2 picks and no Baines. What happened to our 3rd pick? And where the hell is Aaron Baines? I think, Tommy, it's about creating cap space for somebody. That guy was Kemba Walker. So all you guys were wondering out there, as Tommy was as well, and I was at the time as well, it was all to create space to sign a Kemba Walker, which we needed to replace Kyrie with a dynamic guard. But moving on to this team, there's still a problem. Right, we still recognize there's still a logjam at the forward position because of what Adam just said. Who's the guy with the dog? Who's the guy with the toughness? Well, that guy's Marcus Smart, and last year the team could not win without Marcus Smart. So why do we think this year's team will be any different if he's not in the starting lineup, which is going to make someone upset that they're not in the starting lineup? Gordon Hayward worked all summer. He thinks he deserves it. Jaylen Brown is up for a contract extension. Jason Tatum is Jason Tatum. So who starts, and doesn't Marcus ended up being the guy last year? I would say with Kemba Walker, it does make the most sense to start a guy like Smart next to him.
Mannix, I think Scal is hosting your show now.
No, I'm just helping you out.
we've done this a few times before, yeah. Back and forth.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think? Hey, let us do us, all right? You do you.
Adam, how do you think?
He's got a list of questions.
How do you think the starting lineup shakes out then with what Scal said there, the logjam at the wing position?
Yeah, I think Cantor will start out as your starting center, but we were talking about this a little earlier. There's like they've got a problem at the 5 spot, I think. They've got a lot of guys they're hoping can progress and advance. You know, see what Vincent Poirier is. Daniel Tice, they're hoping to get more from. Robert Williams, second-year jump, obviously Cantor. But there isn't like a guy you look at and like, all right, we're set here. And for that matter, a traditional power forward either. So that's something Danny Ainge is going to have a close eye on, I think, early on, kind of seeing, look, we like Jason Tatum, we like Jaylen Brown, Gordon Hayward, all these wings, but we've got to keep an eye on this front court. Yeah, Brad's going to play small a lot, right? Like, there's going to be times where the tallest guy on the court is like 6'7", but you can't always have that.
No, but the thing is, the league has evolved to a point where on certain nights, it's not going to be an issue. It depends on the matchups completely. The league has evolved downward in size, downward in the way it plays, outward in the way the ball, the offense is starting, you know. When Curry crosses midcourt, you got to get your hands up, you know, and soon he won't be the only one. No, that's the only thing that makes me feel better about it. No question.
Yeah, but wait, but let's talk about that. We're going to tip the ball up on October 23rd.
Okay.
Joel Embiid is going to be starting. At the power forward will be Al Horford.
Yeah.
So what is that? It's going to be Gordon
Harris.
That's a tough night.
Gordon Hayward. Okay.
Ryan, that's a tough night.
Forget Philly. Milwaukee Bucks are going to start Lopez. Well, who are you going to put? I guess you can put Jaylen Brown on Lopez. And then on Giannis, you're going to put Time Lord? Like, I don't understand how we're going to start. Like, I don't get how we're going to beat these teams. These two teams, I don't understand how we're going
to
beat them.
Well, we're going to have to beat the other teams. No, and you're absolutely right. There's a flaw here. There's no question there's a flaw. But it's not going to show up every night. You know,
sure.
That's all. It's good, but yes, and these are the teams. Look, I'll say right now, I don't expect them to finish ahead of Philadelphia or Milwaukee. So right now, no, they're the chalk. We haven't even gotten to the defending champions. I don't know what we're going to think about them without Kawhi, whether they're even going to be discussed at all. But no, you're right. No, you're totally right. You mentioned, you know, Cantor is a, you know, Cantor's an intriguing guy. A, we're happy to have him around. He's going to be fun to have around. But B, he's a double-double guy. But there is that other end of the court that is the whole, you know, scenario with him.
They went from being with Baines and Horford, you know, the best defensive front line in basketball. Like, statistics back that up. To right now, I think you put him as one of the worst.
One of the worst,
I mean, without question. That's something that's going to have to change. And, Scal, I remember when Horford was about to become a free agent and there was all that stuff out there about the mystery team, like who was it going to be that was giving him the max offer. I remember talking to people in the front office. They would just tell me, you know, there's probably somebody out there, but please don't be Philadelphia. Just don't let it be Philadelphia. Yeah. That was the one team they didn't want him to go to, and that was the team that he ultimately signed with.
Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia is – so we know Horford's going to take like 12 games off a season, right? He's not going to play hard or he's going to sit out or whatever. But we know also when the playoffs start, he's going to be really good for them. And he's already influenced Embiid. Embiid is down 25 pounds, and he's more serious. And yeah, I could remember Isaiah was good with Horford. Terry Rozier was good. Kyrie Irving was good in a two-man game. Why do we think that Ben Simmons, who we have, he has his flaws, is not going to be good without Horford? So, yeah, I'm a little bit worried about Philadelphia. They probably – correct me if I'm wrong, best starting lineup in the NBA?
Biggest, for sure.
Yeah, they're pretty good. So Philly's going to be – it's going to be a tough matchup, and Al Horford's going to help them. Now, how long is this going to happen with his age and all that? I don't know. And maybe it makes a lot of sense for Danny Ainge to not – and us to, you know, go the direction of Kemba Walker. But this year it's going to sting. Maybe next year it's going to sting. But after that, Celtics could probably, if everything continues to trend the right direction, Philly could drop off.
Yeah, just to add quickly on that, I think Scott makes a good point. That was part of the Celtics' reluctance, is that Horford's going to turn 34 at the end of this season. He dealt with some knee issues for most of last season, and I think the Celtics, like, it's hard right now. Like Scott said, like, this season, like, right now he's healthy. He could get through the season great and be great for them, but, like, when he's 38, making whatever it is, $30 million a year, you know, I think the Celtics were looking a little more long-term.
Philly has to deliver for their fans this year. They teased them long enough. They went through that horrible process, right? And it turned out he was right. He did. They can't, to a point, but they haven't. They're not the Astros. They haven't gotten it done. But they're. This is a point in time when they've got to come through for their fans. They went for it. So they're going to. We're not going to worry about this without. They want Al this year. They're going to be good.
Philly's flawed too, though. Like, they lose Jimmy Butler. Now Ben Simmons has to be that guy on that team that becomes kind of an alpha. This is where, Adam, I kind of disagree. Like, I understand paying Horford a lot of money at 38 is a risk. But if you brought Al Horford back onto this team, there could be some salary cap gymnastics. I'm not totally, you know.
No Kemba Walker. No.
No Kemba.
Yeah, I got confirmation in Danny's living room about this one. And I kept prying and prying and prying and prying. Was there any way it could be done? No, could not have been done.
And I don't blame Al Horford either for not taking the shorter money extension at that point. He was hitting free agency at exactly the right time.
For sure.
Last chance for him.
The one silver lining for all Celtic fans out there that are, we do sound really down on their bigs. They have five bigs. They're all different. They all bring a different element to the game. The game of basketball is changing, as Bob mentioned, and bigs have to play hard. They got to get out. They got to trap. They got to sprint back to the paint. They got to rebound. They got to run the floor. They got to set another screen and dive to the basket, then run back out and set another one. So if you have five of those guys and you just divided the minutes up, there's only 48 minutes in a game. So you could play hard. I mean, really, really hard. So just imagine Robert Williams, like, playing hard, you know, in three-minute increments, four-minute increments. I could see Brad toying with that a little bit, all the way for the first three quarters, three and a half quarter, and then the fourth quarter, whatever the matchup is, maybe even going with a Grant Williams at five late in a game. But the one thing we'll see from these bigs is they'll be flying around. They'll be playing hard. If not, they'll just pull them out and put somebody else in. We have so many guys at that position, and they're all very different.
Adam, to put you on the spot with Jaylen Brown, he's extension eligible this year. The Celtics don't often do extensions. We saw it with Marcus Smart, which played out to him going into restricted free agency. Where do you think that stands with Jaylen and the chances he gets a new deal done before the start of the season?
Yeah, I would say it's unlikely. Rondo was the last Celtics player that got a rookie scale extension. A lot of fans.
Isn't he the only one that's ever got it from Danny?
I don't know. From Danny, it's I'm not sure.
I think he's the only one.
Which, by the way, is often smart. I mean, right. I think letting guys go to restricted. Imagine if the Timberwolves had let Andrew Wiggins go to restricted free agency. Maybe they wouldn't be.
I mean, so just what could happen is you could sign like a two-year, you know, qualifying offer from somebody else. You do have the right to do that.
Right.
So you can go and say, I don't know, Atlanta. Jaylen Brown signs a two-year deal with Atlanta. Now the Celtics could lose him in 2 years. There's options that you can take out. So there is some flaws to it. You can lose a guy for earlier than you want to. But I do think it's smart to wait. I think you can kind of play the market out. If everyone knows that the Celtics are going to match Jaylen Brown, they know less likely to have those offers. You remember Brooklyn was like that team that kept making these offers and putting teams on the spot, front-loading contracts. There is some play there that you have to risk as well.
Yeah, that didn't make teams happy when Brooklyn was doing
the Allen Crabs of the world.
And Brooklyn won each one of those by not signing the guy.
100%. They wouldn't have the team they have now if they had gotten like Tyler Johnson with a $19 million poison pill at the end of that.
Unbelievable, yeah.
So some people see that and like, oh, Danny just doesn't ever want to give out extension. They've negotiated. Like, they made an offer to Marcus Smart. They made an offer to Terry Rozier last year. It wasn't what they were looking for. And God bless Terry Rozier. It all ended up working out for him, somewhat surprisingly. But I would say for Jalen's case, he's a unique one also in that right now he still doesn't have an agent. I'm not sure if he's going to get one. Some people have told me they expect him to either retain one or talk to his marketing kind of executives and have them handle that role. But he's a guy that views himself as like a max-ish player. And I don't think the Celtics are going to offer an extension in that range. So I would be really surprised if anything got worked out.
Bob, you're shaking your head there.
Well, I'm shaking my head. The thought of him, I like him, but I don't like him that much. I don't love him to the point where I even remotely think of him as a max player. You know, but we all know that the world is littered with athletes who, you know, have the highest possible opinion of themselves, and that's fine.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So if he's not a $25 million a year player, I think his max more than that. What number is? He's 22, 21, 20? Like what?
I'm not good at this, Scal.
I know. I'm just pointing it out.
But I know it's lower than that. I mean, I just...
Come on, Bob.
All right, no, I know. I'm living in a theoretical fantasy world that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I would love to be the commissioner of all sports and rearrange all these things and get the proper pecking order in at least two sports that I love, baseball and basketball. But you know, then the job vacancy is still there. I'm volunteering for it. But I don't have Sky. I can't put the numerical. I have to go with my experts here.
Max player or not?
See, the problem is, I would say no. But next summer's free agent class is so bad that there's going to be somebody out there that maxes him out. So
Atlanta has cap space next year.
It could be a question of, do you only want to pay him the 4-year max or the 5-year max, which is what they can give him a new deal.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume the Celtics would want him long term. Yeah. Jaylen Brown wants to be good.
But you're still talking. Then you're talking max is what you're talking about. He's not going to.
I don't know. I don't think it's 170, 150, 170, 140. I don't know if that's a big difference.
Well, the 5-year max is 150. And
no, 170.
I thought the Ben Simmons get 150.
No, that? 170.
Okay, well, something like that. It's big.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. So I just, when we say these things like Jamal Murray, right? Jamal Murray's a good player. But Jaylen Brown's a good player too. Jaylen Brown defends. Jaylen Brown works. Jaylen Brown is not afraid of the moment. You know, Jamal Murray's a good player. Ben Simmons is a good player. But Jaylen Brown is in that conversation.
And that's why there's no way Jaylen will see Jamal Murray, Ben Simmons, and be like, okay. Like, he views himself as just as good or better than Jamal Murray, in his mind at least, even if maybe the rest of the world doesn't. So he's not going to settle for anything less.
All right, let me finish with Jason Tatum, who I think is one of those wild cards. Gordon Hayward's a wild card for sure, how he plays, but can Tatum make that jump into an elite level? Bob, you mentioned that he looked like at the beginning that he was going to be anointed as that guy last year.
2 years ago, and coming off the end of the 17-18 season, weren't we all enthralled? And I mean, I'm right there with Jason Tatum. So we stole the draft. You know, the Sixers got stuck with a number one pick who can't even get on the floor, and we stole the draft. We got this great young talent. And I was looking forward to him to build on it, naturally, because the second year is often a good step-up year. I've seen other guys McHale, for example, became a tremendous force his second year after being a very promising first-year player. I kind of thought that was the kind of progress I was going to expect from Tatum. But it was complicated by the aforementioned Hayward issue and all the stuff that went on there last year. And he didn't react well to it. You know, and we all know, we discussed how his game didn't progress and how he settled for the two and didn't get to the line and so on and so forth. I can't believe we were so misjudged him that badly, or that he's not capable of looking at them in the mirror. If he's not, then we're in trouble. I'm counting on the fact that he's listens to what's been said, he's looking in the mirror, and he's going to come back and be the player that we thought he could have been 2 years ago. Because if he's not, then this season isn't going to turn out the way it should.
Scal, was it the Kobe stuff or Adam?
I want Adam to go first.
you want to
really
finish
want
it
to
off?
Hear.
It's your
I know
world,
where
Scal.
You stand.
So I would say a couple
stand.
Things about Tatum. I think as far as last year, people underestimate the Kyrie impact. When I say that, I mean in terms of the imposing figure of Kyrie, even though he's only 6'1". Guys are like intimidated by him last year. They, especially the younger guys, guys like Tatum, they deferred to him constantly. And if they made a mistake, they were like kind of walking on eggshells around him. I think with him being gone, you see it already, even the way the guys are carrying themselves now, they have like a different comfort level, a different confidence. And then you think media day on Monday, one of the first things Tatum says was, this year for me, free throws, three-pointers, and layups, or dunks. And that was like music to everyone, like to fans' ears, probably to Brad Stevens' ear, like that's what they need from him. So to him, for him, hear him say that and say, that's my mindset, and if he can focus on that and have success, then it's going to be a good thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, you guys know where I stand with this, right? Restricted area, free throw line. All the great players, first of all, great players don't care about walking on eggshells. Just
I'd be
surprised. Just to let you know. If he gets to the free throw line 7 to 9 times a game, it'll be a good Jason Tatum. If he's getting to that restricted area, I don't know, 10 times a game, he doesn't have to score when he's in there, but he has to get there. He has to be on the attack. If we see that Jason Tatum, we see the pull-up jumpers, the step-backs, and all that stuff, low clock when he gets the ball and he makes a few of those, that's fine. But taking that shot with 18 on the shot clock is not ever – good players or great players don't do that.
Let's remember what the great technical discussion was about him in his rookie year. The first step, that awesome first step. We didn't talk about it last year, did we? No. And this is what we're talking.
Yeah, because the first step led to a hesitation dribble, step back, fade away from 19 feet. So who cares you have a good first step? Larry Bird had a slow first step, and he got to the basket,
but
right?
Years ago,
so
that first step, I want – got him to the hoop 2 years ago, what we're saying. I'm totally agreeing with you.
Well, Pierce is a great first step. He ends at the rim. Yeah. Pierce got the free throw line 10 times a game. Yeah. 10 times a game. How many times do you think he was on the attack? He had to hit that restricted area 25 times a night if he's getting to the free throw line 10 times a game. Making a few, kicking it out a few. You've got to be able to get to that restricted area. So if you want to see this team be good, that's how they're going to be good.
And on the next episode of Scal and Friends on the radio.com app.
I'm just helping you out. You're my guy.
I appreciate it.
You're going to work with us this year or what?
That's the plan.
Yeah, my guy.
See you soon. Bob Ryan, Adam Himmelsbach, Brian Scalabrine, thanks all three of you for joining me here. And when we come back, my conversation with the great Mike Gorman.
Thank you, Bob. That was great.
Okay. All right, joining me now, he has been the voice of the Celtics since 1981, nearly four decades, calling games with his broadcast partner, Tommy Heinsohn. Please welcome Mike Gorman.
Thank you. Thank you. Really looking forward to working with Scal this year.
Just Scal?
That's going to be a happy broadcast, I can see that.
He seems enthusiastic about this team's chances.
He's always enthusiastic. He's great to work with. Loves the game.
Does it feel like almost 40 years?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Yeah, there have been so many changes. You know, we were real good when I first came in 81, as you said. You know, we win three championships in a seven-year period or whatever it was. I'm thinking, oh, we do this all the time. Then we go like 0 for 13 years, some of them not even making the playoffs, and then you get back in the 80s and the whole thing happens again. So, I'd like to stick around for one more duck boat.
Mm-hmm. So you're a young guy back in 1981. How do you get connected to this job? What happens to get this gig?
Wow. You want the long version or the short version?
Whatever version you feel is good.
Okay. I'm working in New Bedford, Massachusetts. I was in the military for about 5 or 6 years after I got out of college. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I thought I wanted to be a sportscaster, but I didn't know what being a sportscaster was all about. Anyway, I talked my way into a job in New Bedford, Massachusetts, which led to a guy named Mark Haynes, who unfortunately has passed away, but at the time was the news director of WPRO in Providence, went on to be big with NBC News later in his career. He heard me as we was driving down the Cape one day, and he called me up. This is a funny story. He calls me up and he says, would you like to be the Massachusetts and New England correspondent for WPRO News? I said, yeah. Are you shitting me? That'd be great. So I said, all I got to do is like give some notice here. And he goes, no, don't give notice here. Here's what I want you to do. When you check in the morning, I want you to rip the AP wire. And if there's a fire in Worcester, Massachusetts, I want you to read the AP wire. And then at the end say, in Worcester, I'm Mike Gorman for WPRO News. Then I want you to read the next item. And let's say there's a murder in Portland, Maine. I want you to read the whole thing. At the end, I want you to go, in Portland, I'm Mike Gorman for WPRO News. I said, but Mark, I won't be in those cities. And there's just silence on the other end of the phone. He says, let's go through this again. So I took the job. I lied for about 3 months. And as he predicted, the news director in Providence kept going, who's this guy who's everywhere? He goes everywhere. There's all these stories. So I got hired at WPRO because of these fake stories I'm doing. Fake news, that's what it was. I was ahead of my time. So I'm in Providence, and I get to meet Dave Gavitt and Mike Tringhese, who at the time was his right-hand man. And I'm working at the radio station in Providence. The weekend job opened up on the TV. I auditioned for it and got it. And the week after I got the job on TV to work on weekends, the Monday through Friday guy quit, just abruptly quit, went to Orlando, of all places. So all of a sudden, I go from no TV at all to 7 nights a week I'm doing TV. And the good part about it was in the package with Channel 12, which was the station I worked for, was 5 Providence College games. And so I got to do the play-by-play of 5 Providence College games without having ever done any play-by-play before. And we're at a production meeting one day before the first game we're going to do, and they say, we've got to find a color guy to work with you. And I said, what about Tom Heinsohn? And they said, Tom Heinsohn would want to come to Providence to do this. I said, well, you know, let's give it a shot, see what happens. They said, all right, you do that. Now, to show you how things have changed over the years, I look up in the phone book, the Boston phone book, the number for the Boston Celtics. This lady answers the phone, and she goes, hello, Boston Celtics. And I said, hi, can I speak with Tom Heinsohn? She goes, one moment. That ain't happening anymore, boys. That never happens anymore. One moment, next thing you know, Tommy's on the phone. I introduce myself to him. I say, I got a 5-game package for you. How much? I give him the number. He goes, done. I'll meet you at the first game. So that was 42 years ago. We've been working together ever since.
And he had a lot to do with you landing with the Celtics, right?
Yeah, he did. We were Prism at the time, which was one of the first ventures into pay TV for sports rights, especially. And Tommy was the guy in Boston. And he, you know, because of those 10 games, I think 2 years we'd worked together with Providence College, because of those 10 games we had get done, when the job came up with Prism, which was just going to do home games, he said, just sit back, I'll take care of it. And he did. He's funny. Tommy's a great guy, one of my greatest friends in life. But he got me the job and he sold me an insurance policy at the same lunch. I think the insurance policy came first, actually, and then the job came.
What's it like in the early stages of you know, you're a local guy, and Tommy Heinsohn is a legend. I mean, how do you develop that kind of chemistry?
First game I did with Tom, you know, he let me alone in college basketball because he actually felt I might have known a little bit more about college basketball than he did. But when I got the Celtic job, it was Tommy's show, which is fine with me. But the first game we're going to do is against the Indiana Pacers. We're in that old overhang in the Boston Garden. The Technique sign used to be underneath it. It was a great place to broadcast the game. We were about this high and about this far back from you guys being the court. You could see everything happen in front of you. It was great. So I've got all my stuff on the table, and I've got folders spread out with every player and where they went to college and what they majored in college and how many brothers and sisters they have and how they played last year. And I got all this stuff in different colored ink that I worked like 3 days on for the first game. So Tommy, can we curse in the
Absolutely.
Show? Okay. Tommy comes walking in, cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He goes, "What's that shit?" And I said, "That's my game notes." I won't get really bad here. We don't blank and need no game notes. He picks them up, crumbles them a little ball, throws them off the balcony. He says, "We're going to talk about what we see in front of us. That's what we've been doing for 40 years.
Did you give up game notes then?
I don't do any game notes.
Never after that?
No. Adam was horrified when he did that article on me. I do no preparation at all. I just show up. What did Woody Allen say? 80% of something is just showing up? Yeah, so.
I guess that's the moral of the story. Those 80s teams, now how close were you able to get with some of those guys, the Birds, the DJs, the Robert Parrish?
Not very close. Not very close. I'll leave it at that. It was like somebody was calling you a close friend of the Jersey coach. The reason was we just did the home games. And what I would do is I would come to the Garden, I would go up to the press room, and I would meet Tom, because Tommy's always looking for something to eat. And so we'd go in the press room, we'd sit
even
down.
Even today.
He carries M&Ms in his pocket. He's an 85-year-old guy. There are M&Ms in this pocket over here. There's Reese's paper cups over here. Anyway, I'm getting off the track.
Although even working in studio with Tommy, if he knows we're going across the street, it's the double chocolate milk and whatever else.
It's the milk run. So I drive in, show up at the Garden, go up to the press room, sit down. Every night from the very beginning, have dinner with Johnny Most, which was great for me because he helped me out and gave me tips. He was a solid guy. Johnny was a really solid guy. Then this is the best part. Then we would leave, and Tommy and I would go down to Red's office, and we'd go sit in front of Red. And I would never say a word. I bet you I did this like 90 times and never opened my mouth. I would just go in and sit down and hope Red didn't fire me. And Tommy would ask Red about the game. What's going to happen in the game? Red would sit there, cigar smoke all over the place. And Red's office was unbelievable. There were pictures everywhere. You couldn't see the walls because there were so many pictures. All I could think of was that Peter Sellers movie where Inspector Clouseau has a picture with a gorilla standing here. That was, Red had one of those, I think, somewhere. So we'd do that. Then we'd walk up to the first balcony overhang, do the game. The game would be over. I'd walk downstairs, get in my car, and go home. So I never had any interaction with the players at all. And I found out as time went on later and I started doing all the games, where you develop friendships with players is not game day or game night. It's the off day on the bus when you're traveling, when you're landing at Hanscom Air Force Base at 3 a.m. and it's snowing and you're trying to get each other's car out. That's where you get to meet guys and that's where you get to become friendly with guys. So, I mean, people sometimes say, how could you have done Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish's whole career? And when people ask you, who's your favorite player? I say Paul Pierce in a heartbeat. Because I was friends with Paul. I was legitimately friends with him. We would do things, we'd have conversations about things other than basketball. In answer to the question, those guys in the 80s, I knew them from a distance. I swear some of them didn't know who I was. Robert Parrish used to get on elevators all the time with me and never even acknowledged I was there. So, but he probably wasn't there either.
That's a story.
That's a story.
How long did it take you to get comfortable with Red Auerbach? You said you would sit there in meetings and not say a word. You know,
I would say it was maybe my third year on the job. And the first 15 years I worked for the Celtics, for the various incarnations we had, Prism, Sports Journal, Fox Sports, all these other things, I only had 1 year contracts. So I never knew at the end of the year whether they're going to say bye and somebody else was going to step in. And about the third or fourth year into this, I'm sitting it wasn't a team meeting, it was just a meeting of the broadcasters and Danny was there representing the team and something. And I feel somebody put their hands on my shoulders from behind and stand behind me. And I look up and it's Red. And I'm like, oh, I'm in now. I'm here for the long haul now. And I was.
You have said before that in all the years you've worked together with Tommy, you've only had one or two fights with him.
Tommy's favorite line is we only had one fight and it's not over yet. But, yeah, we had an incident in Orlando that was not pretty where we were at breakfast in a restaurant and Tommy, for some reason, decided it was time to tell me that my job really was kind of any idiot could do my job. And it got to the point that somebody got between us, thankfully, because I probably wasn't going to do too well in that matchup. But yeah, but that was brief. I went upstairs, did my fake preparation for the game, took a nap, worked out. And as I went to get on the team bus, Tommy's standing outside. And I don't know whether he's going to hit me or he's going to say something. So I'm just walking by, and he just grabs me and gives me a big bear hug. And he says, pal. That's what he calls me, pal. We're pal. Okay, we're pals again. And we were.
You mentioned that, you know, at the 80s teams, then you were around for 0 for whatever with the Celtics teams. Yeah. I mean, you were there for significant tragedies in the Celtics time. Yes. I mean, Len Bias passing away in 1986. Mm-hmm. Reggie Lewis in 1993. I mean, those, on a personal level, it's tragic. But that set this team back a lot in that time.
A long way. You know, the Celtics have always had this kind of anti-relationship with the league. They always think the league is out to screw them. And I never really believed that until those two things happened. And I think, geez, something's out to get these guys. Yeah, that was a very hard period to go through because Len Bias, you know, there are people to this day who tell you Len Bias was a better player than Michael Jordan was when they were both in college. And he could have been, Reggie could have mixed in with him when he was more of a veteran. It looked like on paper at the time they had a good plan, and then the plan just blew up. And so, yeah, it was a very difficult time. The franchise felt star-crossed. The players felt maybe this isn't a good place to come play. It was a rough, probably, I've been around for a lot of them. Tommy's been around for all of them, but probably the roughest period this franchise ever gone through, that 7 or 8 year period you just mentioned.
And people, I mean, 1986, they were coming off a championship season, right, when they drafted Len Bias, number two overall. I mean, that never happens where you're a championship team and you have a chance to draft a talent like Len Bias. I mean, that could have kept that championship window probably open for 6 more years, 7 more years.
Without question. Again, the plan was in place. They had the personnel. The transition was ready to be made. Len Bias was going to be the guy. Then he coked out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people here remember maybe more vividly the Reggie Lewis situation. Mm-hmm. What are your memories of that?
Just getting a phone call that Reggie had gone down on the court. And there was also bad speculation at the time that probably because of the Len Bias thing to some degree that there were drugs involved. And it was just a heart issue, as we all know now. Reggie was a really good kid, nice kid. You know, came out of Northeastern. I did his last college game in the NCAA tournament, got to know him a little bit. I didn't know his wife. Had difficult times.
How well did you know him?
Well, again, I wasn't traveling with the team. Mm-hmm. So Reggie was a little more, the more I did, here was my schedule for a while. I did this for about 5 years. It would have been late 70s, 80s. I would do the Celtics on Sunday afternoon in the Garden. I would do a big Monday game on ESPN at the Carrier Dome or someplace crazy like that on Monday. Tuesday, I'd do a Big East Regional game for the Big East Regional Network. Wednesday, I'd come back and do the Celtics game. Thursday, I'd go out and do the Big East Regional Network again. Friday, I'd be in the Garden doing the Celtic game. Saturday, after the Friday night Celtic game, I'd go right to Logan Airport, sleep at that grimy hotel that used to be by Eastern Airlines, get on a plane the next morning, do a noontime regional game on Saturday, then get back on a plane about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, fly to Syracuse, do a Saturday night game in Syracuse, and then come back and do the Sunday Celtics and start the cycle all over again. I once went like 38 consecutive days doing it with at least one game a day. So, yeah, it was fun.
Dave liked it. All right. let me ask you about this past season. Did you come into the year believing that, like, the national narrative that
I did not.
Kyrie, adding Gordon would automatically mean championship?
Here's what I felt was the problem. It seemed very obvious to me. You go to the almost in the Eastern Conference. If you're in the Eastern Conference Finals, you almost get to the NBA Finals the year before with this nucleus of guys. Now you're going to integrate two guys into that nucleus. And you're not integrating them at number 6 and number 8 in your roster. You're integrating them at number 1 and number 2 in your roster. That just wasn't going to work. I mean, that was an impossible task for Brad to manage the egos of these other guys who are like, WTF here, come on. We went to the, you know, went to the finals last year, just about in the finals. All of a sudden, these two guys come in and we're running plays for them, and all we do is run plays for them, and I'm suddenly the fourth option on this and the third option on this. I just thought it was doomed from the very beginning. I'm not trying to change my hindsight if I wish you had something to play, because I said it at the time. I was asked by the Celtics not to say it too much more, but I just didn't see it as a viable solution to their problem, that you would have to bring in a one or two guy. And then, you know, these guys were, I thought, kind of nice. Then you brought in Kyrie, who was really just a jerk. You know, he's a wonderful player. I mean, if you're a play-by-play guy, you love doing games that Kyrie's in because he's got such an unbelievable handle and makes great shots at big times and makes great plays. But off the court, I mean, the young man needs some guidance here. I agree with Bob Ryan in that this is not the last team he's going to play for. He can't be one of these guys who may go to the Hall of Fame, and he did win a championship in Cleveland with the LeBron James, happened to be on the same team. He's not leading anybody to a championship. He has skill level to do it, but unless he changes his personality, which is unlikely.
I asked Scal this question. I'll ask you. Did you see a difference in the 17-18 version of Kyrie and the one from last season?
17-18 version of one? No, not particularly. I travel with the team. I'm with them on buses. I'm with them in airports. I'm with them, as they say, in the snow in Hanscom's parking lot, shoveling out each other's cars. In the time that Kyrie Irving was with the Celtics, I bet we didn't exchange 10 words.
That's unusual.
He didn't want to talk. He'd get on an elevator. He'd look at you and just look the other way. You're the only two people on the elevator. You just flew in to town together. You know, I just found him really a strange dude. Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about the blame pie of last season. How much do you put on him for what happened, and how much do you put on all the other circumstance?
How much do I put on Kyrie?
On Kyrie versus, splitting it up, I guess.
85% on Kyrie.
Really?
Yeah. Because he was Kyrie. He was that guy. He was going to be the guy. And he was going to be the leader of the team. He talked about coming here. I want to have my own team. I want to be the leader of the team. Then he's throwing people under the bus left and right. It just was not meant to be. And again, I would like to see the kids succeed. I got nothing against the kid. I mean, I know this is going to air and someone's going to say, hey, Mike Gorman called Kyrie this. I'd like to see the kid be successful as long as it's not at our expense, but he gave no evidence last year that he was going to become a changed guy in the near future. And Scal's best line was the one about the grandfather dying and you suck 3 months later in the playoffs.
What did you think of that when you heard his part of his explanation was what happened in October?
I stopped listening to him. I really did. Yeah. I don't have to deal with players that way, which I like my job. I can just be an observer and let Scal and Tommy get in all the trouble, although I'll get in trouble off this thing here unless he edits it.
But Tommy can bounce back. Remember when Tommy criticized Al Horford, said he wasn't a real superstar that Al signed? It's just like, it's just Tommy.
Sure. Brad Lojas was right there with Bill Russell. Brad, Bill.
Oh, that was Steemsma.
Steemsma.
Yeah. Steemer, yeah. Greg Steemsma. Yeah. And Jordan Crawford with the James Harden comparison. Yeah. That was another one. I love
Tommy just fires away, you know? He's 85 years old. He's not worried what you think. not anymore.
your expectations for this season, new group, you've seen a little bit of them in training camp. You know what a lot of these guys can do. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Kemba stepping into that role, and his Cantor, the new man in the front court. What do you think?
The biggest theme for me for the Celtic team this year is there are a lot of guys with something to prove. You know, Tatum, Brown, Smart, the coach. You can go right down the line. There are a lot of guys who have something to prove to show they're more the team and the guys of 2 years ago as the guys we saw last year. So I think the key for the Celtics and the key for Brad Stevens is going to be, is can he take these guys who all have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder and want to show how good they are, can he get them to do it within a team concept, with the idea that wins will be what they ultimately will be judged by, not individual scoring averages or rebounding averages or whatever. So I'm optimistic, but I agree with Bob. I think right now on paper, Philly's better. I think Milwaukee's better. Toronto, nobody talks about that. What was Toronto, 18-6 without
They know how to play without Kawhi Leonard.
They know how to play without Leonard. So they're not going to be any easy out. Everybody's telling me Atlanta, believe it or not, is better. People want to say Miami's better. I've never been a big Jimmy Butler fan, but they're going to be better. I would say fourth place, last playoff spot, would be where I'd put them.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, every great broadcaster has kind of a catchphrase or something that they're known for. Marv Albert with Mike Breen. Got it. Where did that come from? That's what everybody's heard over the years on every big shot that's made.
I think I stole it from somebody.
Did you? Okay.
Johnny Most, again, when I first got the job, I didn't know how Johnny was going to treat me because he's Johnny the Moose, you know, and I'm just this guy who's coming in. And instead, he was just from day one, as I mentioned earlier, he was my best friend. He tried, do you need help on this? You should do this, you should do that. And he said to me, he said, come up with a signature phrase that you use all the time. His was bang. And he said, so I came up with about three or four of them, and I used them in a couple of games, and he said to me, he said, got it. That's the one that works. And I'm like, yes, sir, John.
Well, Mike, appreciate you being here. Always appreciate listening to you on the broadcast and working with you as well. Thank you.
Dorchester, thank you.
Dorchester in the house over there. And thank everybody for being here today. Appreciate you guys coming out for the podcast.